Welcome to Conversations for a Brave New World with Donna, Sonia and Cliff, where we bring you a global, national and local focus on gender, sexuality and feminism.
So welcome to today's show, where we shine a spotlight on the incredible women in the field of paramedicine. I'm your host, Sonia Maria, an associate professor at Charles Sturt University, and I've had the privilege of witnessing the remarkable journey of women making strides in emergency healthcare. My own professional path in emergency healthcare has led me through a myriad of experiences, from working in ambulance services nationally and internationally to assuming critical care positions and senior management responsibilities. Throughout my career, I've been deeply involved in policy development and the creation of evidence-based guidelines, all in the pursuit of ensuring high quality and improved patient outcomes. But today is not about me, it's about celebrating the remarkable contributions of two incredible guests. Joining us is Alicia McFarlane, an experienced intensive care paramedic and current lecturer in paramedicine at Charles Sturt University. Alicia's passion for gender equality in the profession drives her research, which focuses on the experiences of female paramedics in Australia. She is a fierce advocate for promoting diversity and inclusion in all aspects of paramedicine. Our second guest is Louise Reynolds, the Chief Paramedic Officer with Safer Care Victoria, serving as the state's principal advisor on quality and safety matters relating to paramedicine. Louise is not only Australia's first female paramedic PhD, but is also a seasoned professional with extensive international experience in both the paramedicine and higher education sectors. Both Alicia and Louise have made outstanding contributions to their fields with research and advocacy that have driven positive change in the professional culture of paramedicine. So let's get started and celebrate the achievements of these remarkable women in paramedicine. Hi, Alicia and Louise, how are you going?
Really good, thanks. Great to be here. Thank you, Sonia, for the invitation, and great to see Alicia as well.
So we're incredibly honoured to have you both here today and sharing your wealth and knowledge with us. So Alicia, can you tell us about your journey in paramedicine and what led you to become such a passionate advocate for gender equality?
My background in paramedicine started 20 years ago in my 20th year associated with the profession, which is hard to believe if I'm honest, but it started probably from a place of a sense of wanting to give back to the community and a sense of social justice. I think having grown up in a family that whilst we grew up in quite a privileged area, my family itself was not privileged. And I guess I saw great social inequity growing up and probably saw some social inequity in regards to accessing things like education and in particular healthcare. So I suppose they were the main drivers, even if at the time maybe I didn't know that's what my driver was. So I joined, and it was a join as opposed to study. I joined an ambulance service when I was 21. I was nearly 22. And then I suppose I just progressed my way through the service into different positions. I started just as an on-road paramedic and then progressed up to be an intensive care paramedic and then undertook some different project roles and also landed in education as well. So I've done quite a lot in the education field, where now ultimately I work as a lecturer in paramedicine, which is interesting having studied teaching as an 18 and 19-year-old, and I've come full circle where now I'm back teaching full-time again.
So your research focuses on the experiences of female paramedics in particular. What are some of the key insights you've gained from your research that shed light on the challenges and opportunities faced by women in this field?
Yeah, look, I think what's interesting, having interviewed lots of women since I sort of started my interest in this area, was that women often think that their problems are their own, or they're very individual, or that perhaps in some way that they've been generated by themselves, if you will, which is quite an interesting take on it. But in fact, what I can say is, but having interviewed so many women, is the stories, whilst they do have individual components to them, they definitely have shared aspects, lots of commonality between women. They definitely share very similar barriers to career progression. They share similar cultural challenges within all their organisations, whether they be a jurisdictional ambulance service, a private ambulance service or otherwise. And I think they all at some point have questioned their validity within the profession, if that truly is the place that they belong, because at some point most of them have experienced, whether it be in person or third hand, they've personally experienced what it is to feel something other than wanted, I suppose, in the profession, or that they actually have a place in the profession.
What are some examples of that, Alicia? Give me some ideas about what kind of challenges that there are happening out there at the moment for women.
Yeah, so definitely some of the common ones, which I don't think would be a surprise to anyone listening, is around family commitments and the domestic labour that's undertaken by women. So whilst there's a level of discomfort when we talk about women being primary caregivers, because we'd like to think that we've in some way moved on, that perhaps those responsibilities are now shared, and it's not to suggest that they're not, but we do know the evidence tells us that the primary caregiver and the domestic labour still predominantly falls to women within every family unit or household. And so women, whether they be in regional, remote or metropolitan areas, still share that load. And so that is very much a barrier for them being able to engage in the profession, certainly to stay in the profession, and certainly to achieve their career goals, because a lot of their career goals are based around their ability to engage in full-time, uninterrupted work. And for a lot of women, that just isn't possible, not just because they might choose to have children, but it's also because if someone becomes ill or suffers a long-term disability and requires a carer, that role often falls to a female member of that family. And so women often have breaks, intentional or unintentional breaks in their career, and therefore, I suppose, discomfort in applying for jobs for fear of not being able to meet the expectations of the employer in those roles.
And look, as someone myself who has moved through different ambulance services and has had that challenge, that was something that I look back and I actually regret in some ways, is the time taken away from my family, because I had to live up to those expectations by other people of providing this almost unrealistic sense of, you know, loyalty to the job and the occupation that we're seeing in paramedicine, that you have to be in it for the whole hog, you know, you're not allowed casual hours, etc.
And I think the casual hours concept is also interesting, isn't it? Or the flexible workplace arrangements is something else that's important to discuss, because it's seen as something that's outside of the norm. It's not what we should expect as people, as paramedics, as women, whatever you want to group it as, because if you're not working the standard shift work pattern, then you're seen to be difficult or outside of the norm. And so I did note a few weeks ago on social media that women who'd asked for flexible workplace arrangements in a particular area had been referred to as the mum bus. And those ambulances being called mum buses were especially given predominantly low acuity or perceived lower acuity jobs and transfers for the day. Now, I'm not sure about anybody else, but I find that unbelievably offensive to my ability to function as a professional. And I couldn't believe that we'd adopted the name for ourselves, that we'd allowed the adoption of the name. Now, I don't know where it came from, but I think the reason that I was so against the name is I wasn't, for me, having come back from having a child, I wasn't a mum bus. I was a paramedic who just needed alternate hours to be able to engage in my profession. And all I could also think about was, if a male colleague was put on that ambulance, what was the perception then around that person working on the vehicle? Was he mocked for working on something called a mum bus? Because I don't think it would have been a positive association.
Have you personally faced any obstacles or biases as a female paramedic? And how have you overcome them, if you have?
Yeah, I mean, I think I probably faced more than I would like to acknowledge. I think I faced a lot early on in my career, but maybe didn't know that's what it was at the time. I think my desire to belong and fit in and be part of whatever the culture was seemed to supersede any discomfort that I had, you know, working extra long hours, using particular language, whatever it might have been. I think if it was a bit of a fit in or jump out kind of arrangement, I think I definitely had those. And I also remember coming back from having had my son and listening to my manager down the hallway speak to another manager and say that he only had half a paramedic on his staff because I had come back as a mum. You know, I think there's lots of barriers along the way. I also experienced the barrier as someone that had worked, as a woman that had worked in a metropolitan area and then having moved to a regional area and then being asked to progress my career, I would have to go back to a metropolitan area, but then having had children or family responsibilities, I wasn't able to do that. And I remember a very senior manager telling me, well, it was my choice, family or career, and that I couldn't possibly have both. Now, I'm not suggesting that men don't face the same obstacles, but I think women face them more frequently based on that domestic labour and the fact that they're the ones that have the children. So they're my personal barriers. And I think I judged a lot of women early in my career about perhaps the way that they dressed or that, you know, the women that wore makeup to work or those types of things. I used to think the same. I used to think, well, you're not, for whatever, maybe that you're not a paramedic, but you're a particular type of paramedic because you choose to take pride in your personal experience or express yourself in a certain way. And I didn't. And therefore,
really interesting comment. Can we just talk about that one? Out of curiosity, how many women do you think wore makeup back in the day compared to now? Louise, what's your thoughts about that? I'm just curious. That'd make for a fascinating study.
Yeah.
It was really interesting back in the day because, like Alicia, I was just turning 22 when I first joined through the vocational pathway. And I remember coming with long, obviously curly hair that had to, you know, very strict, obviously, guidelines in terms of, you know, appearance. So obviously the loops of the earrings couldn't be any bigger than whatever. But it was presented, my hair had to be obviously put up and all that kind of thing. Makeup was not really obviously considered because it was so gendered towards being heavily masculine. You know, it was this masculinity that obviously was all pervasive because it was predominantly male. You know, it was at least 75% male, and it was the novelty of women, you know, joining the ambulance service in 1992. This was obviously at a time in South Australia where it was a huge influx of paid staff that were replacing the largely volunteer staff through that vocational pathway. So we were getting women from all occupations, you know, hairdressers, nurses. In my diploma group, there was registered and enrolled nurses. And, you know, that those women, you know, came with obviously knowledge and obviously a way of conducting themselves in a health profession, which, you know, lent itself to not wearing makeup. But other groups, other diploma groups, you know, with the hairdressers or they were all range of women.
Mm. I think about it now, and as an academic at the uni with the students coming through, and I, you know, I can't help but look at them and, you know, their perfect hair, perfect makeup and things like that. And I think, wow, it's really changed, right? Like I remember starting off, we would never have worried about those kind of things. And I do think that we were masculinizing ourselves, making ourselves look more manly and tough and strong.
Certainly at a very minimum defeminized. So if you couldn't be masculine, you just didn't want to stand out as a woman. So even if you couldn't have masculine features, whatever they are, you just didn't want to stand out as anything other than that group of people.
That really supported a lot of my findings, which was, you know, really about masculinizing our femininity. And I do think that came about because of the ritualized practices where we had to not care. So I think that part of that emotional labor, we were discouraged from caring. So from that emotional caring, the compassion. The other thing was, but also because the uniform, so symbolically we had to wear pants, you know, that there was that sort of hidden, you know, we were hidden, had to hide the fact that we had breasts or shape. The other thing was about the tasks, because we had to lift, you know, we had to be physical. There was a physicality about the role. And, you know, when we ever went to, you know, older people, you know, oh dear, can you, you know, are you okay to lift, you know, and it's just like,
do you drive the ambulance too?
I was about to say, do you drive? You know what? They let me vote as well.
It's outrageous.
You know? Yeah. So, the masculinizing of our femininity is a thing, you know, that we had to carry ourselves. We had to be these emotional fortresses. We had to undertake the task, which was very physical, and the emotional challenges. We had to, do the facade and the charade, as I called it. So,
I couldn't help but thinking when you're both talking that we've noticed a lot of changes in the profession in general anyway. Like back at, you know, we've gone a long way now from just throwing them in the back and taking them to hospital. I mean, you know, patients. We would put people in the back and we'd take them to hospital, and we really didn't provide a lot of care. And I guess in some ways, you know, I can't help but thinking of women coming into the role, how much more care we're actually also providing, whether that's just the changing of healthcare in general, or whether women have actually had an influence over the way that paramedicine has also actually developed over time as well, because we are carers more so probably traditionally than men. So being introduced into a role, it's actually brought some of that maybe with it as well. Do you know where I'm coming from?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. It's a really interesting concept. It's almost, is it the chicken or the egg? Have we introduced women to increase our care and compassion, or has the introduction of more women into the profession resulted in more care and compassion? And I don't know which one of those things it is, or if it is even true. But what's interesting is when you go up to, you start to get into managerial ranks within, certainly within jurisdictional ambulance services, it's a phenomenon to watch women in those positions replicate some really poor masculinized behaviors that they themselves experienced to fit in at that level of management. So it's a bit of a phenomenon that maybe we come in with more care and compassion. I'm not sure if we do necessarily, but as we try and find our position, or try and have career goals or move on within an organization, you know, up the ranks, some of that gives way to culture and fitting in and what it means to be valued. I think that's a really interesting conversation around what drives those types of things, and at what point does that change? I'm not sure.
That's a good segue for you, Louise. I mean, you've gone from someone who started in 92 to, you know, the random female who works on the truck, to now a really senior leadership position. You're first woman to get a PhD in the profession, and now in this role that you're in now. Tell me about your experiences with that.
Yeah, it was a really interesting journey for me. And just to sort of pick up on some of the points that you've made, is where I went through, my career in diploma training and then top-up degree at Charles Sturt University, you know, as it was emerging there in the mid-90s, and then into sort of the question, you know, why are we doing things that way? And that led me on my research journey. And at the time, the ambulance service was largely, as Alicia said, inflexible. The inflexible work practices on how can I combine, you know, these aspirations for something else, and how do I do that in a part-time capacity to manage a shift working partner and a child. And it was a senior manager, a senior leader, a woman, who said, you either go back on the road or you leave. And it was really hard, because it was like, I'm looking to you as a mentor, as one of the few senior women in leadership, and to be given an and or an or choice, you either go back on the road or you leave. And it's like, well, okay, I just have to leave. And thankfully, education, you know, the university saw this young person who was doing some research and in paramedicine, and I was able to sort of move over into higher education in the paramedic program as it was then. And thankfully, you know, nurturing and valuing the questioning and the inquiry, and they could see the value of what my research was going to be contributing to, and was able to help me finish my PhD.
Now tell us about your role now. What's going on? And
right. I feel quite presidential. So since my appointment in March, I've had my ticked over my first 100 days. So the role of Safer Care Victoria, the Chief Paramedic Officer, sits in the Clinical Professional Leadership Unit. So I sit with the other chiefs, so the Chief Medical, the Chief Allied Health, Chief Mental Health, Chief Nursing Midwifery Officers. So the Office of the Chiefs provide that clinical professional leadership. And it's really, the roles are around connecting and advice and guidance in our, obviously, our areas. So it's really a highlight of my career. You know, it really is about impact, to be able to impact here in Victoria, you know, the population health outcomes. Yeah.
I was just thinking about the comment you just reminded me about how a lot of our audience would know that, you know, there's much more women in paramedicine now than there was ever in the past. And in fact, I think it's right, Alicia, are we at 50% roughly or something like that now?
Yeah, we're at about 50%. And it's really good that you bring it up. And because I've been thinking a lot over the last week or two as I hear people talk about gender parity, but they conflate the two terms, gender parity and gender equality. They're often used interchangeably. And yeah. But what we know is that gender parity doesn't equal gender equality. It's not how it works. Using phrases parity and equality interchangeably is really problematic for us as a profession. It's problematic for us as a society, but it's problematic for us as a profession to say we've achieved gender parity, tick, we're done.
I'd like to get some, like, just some final statements from you about your thoughts about women in paramedicine in general, where we're at, where we're going to.
If I give some advice to a woman thinking about coming into the career, make sure that you are connected, supported, and people within your wise Council of Wise Women, you know, who is on my Council of Wise Women? So people that I can, in industry and outside of industry, that, you know, can support me. So I think that that's something to use and to leverage your connections throughout different life stages, and for that advice. If you can't see it, you can't be it.
I would probably like to say two things. One, which is whether you're a man or a woman, if you find yourself in a position of power or a position of privilege or a managerial position or whatever that position might be, that your support and advocacy is what will make someone feel valued, is what's important in our profession. The thing that drives culture is its people. And so until we all accept a level of individual responsibility for change, we won't see any. If we're driven by only organisational values, the culture will remain the same, because the values are very slow to change. We have to change it for ourselves. Those that are in positions of influence and power and privilege have the opportunity to support those that maybe don't have a voice. And I think that is incredibly important. And the other thing that I would love to see is organisations who are trying to make a change, not to rush the implementation of something that we don't know if it's worthwhile. And by that I mean, in a rush to look outwardly like we're doing something, like an organisation is doing something, we sometimes miss the mark. And I think it's really important to take the time to understand a problem and develop a really meaningful intervention so that to change culture, because in the process of rushing things and implementing something that's not sustainable, what you do is create distrust in a population that already has a level of distrust because of the historical gender imbalance and inequities. That's what I would love to see, a little bit more care, a little bit more time put into whatever those projects look like, is that we understand what is our purpose and what will it mean for the people that we're trying to improve things for.
As we come to the end of this empowering radio show, we extend our heartfelt gratitude to our extraordinary guests, Your presence here today has enriched our understanding of the vital role women play in paramedicine and the importance of gender equality in healthcare. I'm now joined by my co-hosts, Dr. Cliff Lewis and Dr. Donna Bridges. Donna, what are your thoughts about our conversations today? Do you see similarities to other workplaces where they've been previously male-dominated and are now gender-balanced?
Oh, absolutely, Sonia. You see exactly the same issues happening in areas like the military, construction, anything that was previously the men's work domain and women have been integrating into it. There are always issues, and you've raised some of those. Some of them, I think, such as the issues of having a family and the caring roles, I think mask a greater problem of those masculinized cultures.
That's really interesting. What do you think some of those greater problems are?
Women are often resisted in those cultures because men don't want women coming in and taking their jobs. They're threatened by that. They're concerned that the industry will change, perhaps that it will become feminized and the pay will go down. And for some, they're not bothered by it at all, but within the dominant culture, there's resistance. And so they're not able to stand up to that resistance, which is understandable.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting comment. And I actually see that as someone who has worked in paramedicine. I would agree that I've seen definitely both ends of the spectrum and in between. It's quite convenient, I feel, for men to not accept women if it has to change the processes of whereby they might get a promotion too. Cliff, tell me about the stereotypes in terms of what you can see from the conversations that we've had.
Thanks, Sonia. I think there's an interesting problem here in terms of how masculinities can play its role. And I think it's particularly challenging when we think about a caring profession like paramedicine. Now, let me unpack what I mean by that. When I look at it from an LGBT perspective, masculinities dictate the norms and norms of behaviour. And norms of behaviour that are allowed and enabled within that space, be it, you know, in the ambulance, be it at the job. But imagine if you have to constantly surveil how you operate. Imagine if your brain is constantly thinking about censoring and self-editing. How much of your brain capacity then do you actually use on your job? And what risks can that cause if you're trying to constantly be careful of who you are? So I tend to wonder how that actually undermines the profession by dictating a norm, which doesn't allow people to be themselves.
Alicia's work, where she looked at women in paramedicine, one of the points that she made in her thesis was around that a woman's clinical work that she did was actually impacted by workplace everyday sexism. And those impacts actually changed the way that she provided patient care.
Most definitely. Imagine if you are trying to respond to something really quickly, but at the back of your head, you've also got other cues about, I can't behave in this way, or I've got to behave in this particular script of masculinization. I think when you have a gendered view of any discipline or profession, it does sometimes bring out the worst of that gendered view, not necessarily the best of it.
Yeah, exactly.
It is certainly interesting, isn't it, that there is gender parity being achieved in paramedicine, but still a lot of gender inequality, very high rates of bullying in the profession overall, and a problem with sexual harassment.
Okay, well, that's it for the show. Thanks, Donna and Cliff, for coming along today and providing some final summary comments for us. I hope everyone's enjoyed the show.
Thank you for listening. This show is brought to you by the Gender Network. To get involved or find out more, simply Google the Gender Network at Charles Sturt.